to meet my wife with content, but I find her in her closet, in a hot fit of railing against me.
Oh, Debs Willett!
Have you seen her?
No. I've heard.
What have you heard?
She slanders me. Oh, she goes about the place in riches and with fancy black spots, telling all and everyone that it is I who have wronged her. Not the truth, Sam. So all think that I am a bad person, not her, the vile slut. Have you seen her?
No. Of course I haven't, Lizzie.
But you would lie anyway.
On the Bible itself, I have not seen her. Let us not begin this again, please, Lizzie.
Oh, Sam.
I know nothing of Debs Willett, and not what she does, nor what becomes of her. Though God knows my devil that is within me doth wish that I could. I did at last bring my wife to very good and kind terms, poor heart, and I was heartily glad of it. So down to supper, and she read to me, and then with all possible kindness to bed.
Despite Sam's promises, a chance sighting of Debs leads to a secret meeting. That's in tomorrow's episode at the same time.
The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now we travel to Central Europe at a key time in the 20th century when, according to the author Mark Edmondson, two very different destinies were being played out in The Death of Sigmund Freud.
In the late autumn of 1909, two men, who each in his own way would transform the world, were living in Vienna. One was Sigmund Freud, the creator of psychoanalysis, who would become the most renowned and controversial thinker of the 20th century. The other man, whose impact on humanity would be more dramatic, was Jung. He had come to the great city in hopes of making his fortune as an architect and an artist. But when his money ran out, he lived on the street, sleeping in doorways and on park benches. Finally, he found a home in a men's shelter where he gave speeches about the Jews and the communists and about Germany's exalted destiny among nations. None of his fellow residents imagined that Adolf Hitler would ever be of consequence in the world. If Hitler and Freud passed each other on the street during the cold late autumn of 1909, what would each of them have seen? In Hitler, Freud would have seen a rank denizen of the crowd, a street rat. Freud was no populist. For his part, Hitler would have seen a Viennese burgher. He despised the upper middle class, and probably would have recognized Freud as a Jew. The encounter would have left the young Hitler seething. In middle age, Sigmund Freud was a full-faced man with a burgher's well-insulated body and a regal brown beard, streaked with grey. He was not tall, but his presence was formidable. He had composed and published his first major work, The Interpretation of Dreams, and he was well begun in his exploration of the unconscious. Brilliant young men and some gifted women were gathering around him. He was creating something like a movement. Up until 1909, Freud, to speak broadly, had been fascinated with the dynamics of desire. He wanted to know how the unconscious, the seat and source of desire, worked, and in particular how it expressed itself in neuroses and dreams. But as time went on, Freud became more preoccupied with the issue of authority and would begin to write a sequence of books and essays that focused on how authority became toxic, authority gone bad. Almost three decades later, in 1938, the former street rat was heading again for Vienna, this time with with thousands of troops at his back. At 81, Freud was bent and thin. His beard had gone white, but he could still speak with force and conviction, despite the prosthesis implanted in his jaw to replace the teeth and bone that had been removed during his operations for the cancer that had tormented him 15 years. Freud knew that the cancer was the result of his incessant cigar smoking, and he had been told many times to stop. But he wouldn't. He loved cigars too much. At the height of his consumption, he smoked 20 a day. When things were especially bad, he sometimes used a clothespin to open his frozen, aching jaw and wedge one more into his mouth. Throughout his life, Freud had been a ferocious worker, able to push through intense pain, but now he was spending much of his time lying down on the couch that his patients used when they came for analysis at Berggasse 19, the apartment where he had been living for 50 years, and that he shared with his wife, Martha, her sister, Aunt Minna, and Anna, Freud's daughter. Here Freud had developed his psychoanalytical practice, raised 6 children, and written the books and papers that made him and his ideas known throughout the West. He affirmed the existence of the Oedipal complex, shocking the world with the view that all children want to have sex with their mothers and do away with their fathers. Not only that, he believed infants were sexually alert and sexually responsive beings. But as rebellious as Freud could be, and delighted in being, he was a man attracted to convention. Being asked if he raised his children according to the tenets of psychoanalysis, Freud simply grunted and replied that he raised his children as children, that is, pretty much according to convention, and that was all there was to it. He was interested in conventional success, in money, in fame, in a sterling reputation, in maintaining an impeccable bourgeois household. From the outside, Berggasse 19 looked conventional enough. In the back of the dwelling, Freud had fashioned his inner sanctum of 2 rooms, and it was here that he retired during the bad days in February and early March, to lie on the famous divan, nurse his aching jaw, and see what Adolf Hitler would do. When Freud was very young, his father told him a story about how he had gone for a walk one Saturday, decked out in a new fur hat. Along came a Christian, who with a single blow knocked the cap off Jacob Freud's head and into the mud.
"Jew, get off the pavement," the Christian hollered.
"And what did you do?" Freud asked. He wanted to hear how dear Papa stood up to the bigot and put him in his place. But this is not what Jacob told him.
"I went into the roadway and picked up my cap."
The young Freud, he couldn't have been more than 10 or 12, was outraged.
"This struck me as unheroic conduct on the part of the big strong man who was holding the little boy by the hand," Freud reflected years later. "I contrasted this situation with another that fitted my feelings better, the scene in which Hannibal's father, Hamilcar Barca, made his boy swear before the household altar to take vengeance on the Romans."
From then on, Freud resolved that he would struggle with the Gentiles when he had to, and never step aside. On March the 11th, 1938, Sigmund Freud did something that he disliked. He listened to the radio. His son, Martin, says it was the only occasion he recalled his father doing so. What Freud heard was the voice of Kurt von Schuschnigg, the Austrian Chancellor, was resigning from office. As soon as the speech was over, Vienna came alive with the chants of the Austrian Nazis.
"One people, one nation, one leader. Death to the Jews."
Freud might have been able to hear them from his window. The next morning, German troops crossed over into Austria with no opposition. The annexation, the Anschluss, had begun. The night before the Führer's arrival, Freud called a meeting of the Vienna Psychoanalytical Society at Berggasse 19. The decision was to disband the society, with the possibility of reforming it wherever Freud might settle, assuming he could, or wanted to, find a way out of Vienna. Jews in Vienna came under attack, the streets becoming a sort of black carnival where all the bottled-up hatred of the last decades exploded into the open. The Nazis arrested 21,000 people during the first days of the Anschluss and sent them off to Dachau. Anyone who had been reading Freud would not have been surprised at the events of March 1938. Attentive to the sadistic side of humanity, Freud believed that even the most civilized people nurse fantasies of rape and plunder. To Freud, we are all in our hearts criminals.
Our dreams convince us that these things are so.
Nor does Hitler and the Nazis seem to surprise him much.
Something like this was inevitable, Freud said.
Frequently, our strongest desire is to find a figure who will control our desires. We wish to be dominated. We wish to submit. On the day that Hitler addressed the citizens of Vienna, a gang of Nazis invaded the Verlag, the printing press that published Freud's books. The press was at Berggasse 7, just a few doors away from Freud's apartment, and Martin Freud, a lawyer, was there already, doing what he could to dispose of any records. Papers stored at the Verlag revealed that Freud, like many Viennese Jews, had placed money in foreign accounts. This was now illegal. If the Nazis discovered it, they would surely confiscate the funds and perhaps jail Freud and his family too. Quickly the Nazis got into the safe, emptied its contents on the desk, and began combing through them. The situation was dangerous, but also bordering on dark comedy. The men were not hardcore Nazi ideologues. They were anti-Semitic thugs. It was open season on Jews and on Jewish property, and they weren't going to be left out. At a certain point, Martin petitioned the group for a cup of tea. This was put to a vote, and it was decided that, yes, it would be all right, provided that Martin Freud washed his own cup and saucer. Martin requested that the office boy wash them, and this too was put to a vote and approved, even though the office boy had converted to Nazism at about the moment the gang arrived. In early afternoon, Martin was left alone with one of the Nazis, a melancholy-looking middle-aged man who looked more like a head waiter than a soldier. It became clear that what he wanted was money. Martin gave him all he had in his pockets. The guard was so grateful that he began honouring Martin's requests to use the bathroom. Time after time, Martin went along the corridor, on each visit scooping up a handful of compromising documents and flushing them down the elaborate Viennese sewer system. It turned out that across the street from the Verlag lived a Nazi who was watching the proceedings through his window. He saw that when Martin and his guard left the room, other members of the gang crept back in and pocketed the coins and bills that were lying on the desk, a disgrace to the party. The outraged neighbour called party headquarters, and in time the district commander of the SA made his way to the press, huffing and puffing. The rabble fell in at his sharp command, and after one or two were ordered to remain, to clear up the mess in the office, the main body marched off. While the Nazis were breaking up, Anna Freud arrived. Freud was surely disturbed to learn of the threat to Martin that day, but the thought of his daughter being on the scene would have been more than he could bear. Anna was the great comfort of his old age, also his hope for the future. He was obsessed with the continuity of his work and had come to see Anna as the one who could do the most to ensure it.
Anton Lesser was reading from The Death of Sigmund Freud by Mark Edmondson, which was abridged for radio by Penny Lester and produced by Duncan Minshall. Tomorrow, we enter Freud's inner sanctum, and the Nazis make a surprise visit.